Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks a lot for coming. You made it this far. We're into Friday afternoon after lunch. Hopefully you'll be able to stay with us. But we're all really excited to be here today, so thanks a lot for coming. So my name is Lindsay Cole. I work with a workers' cooperative called Sustainability Solutions Group. And we do quite a bit of green building consulting, sustainable design, sort of consulting and facilitation work, as well as some more interesting kind of policy level and kind of research work that relates to sustainability in general. So I want to talk to you today about a study that we did on Salt Spring Island, finished about 6 or 8 months ago. And so for those of you that don't know Salt Spring Island, who aren't from around here, we are not on this map right now, but you can see Richmond there, in the top, which is very near the airport. And you can see the green arrow there, Salt Spring Island. So it's one of the Gulf Islands, or for the Americans in the room, it's one of your San Juan Islands. It's one of, I think it's our biggest Gulf Island, is that right? And probably the most populated as well. So Salt Spring Island was initiated an official community plan review in, I think it was 2006. And they decided that as part of the official community plan review, they wanted to look at the implications of their planning work through the lens of greenhouse gas emissions. So our group with Peter's group, actually Holland Bars, worked to develop some scenarios around planning for different future development land use patterns in the context of their official community plan through the lens of greenhouse gases. So Salt Spring, it's a pretty cool place. How many of you have actually been there? Most of you have been there. Great. It's a pretty wonderful little island. Has undergone a lot of changes over the last 10 years or so. I think average population growth over the last 10 years is about 2% a year. Only about 70% of the people that live there full time. A lot of them are sort of temporary residents, come for the summer or come on weekends from Vancouver and other places. Very kind of classic West Coast island town. And a lot of really great characters that live there. And there's this organization there called the Earth Festival Society that did a baseline greenhouse gas study in 2004. And they found, this is a local sort of advocacy organization, nonprofit organization, and they were interested in coming up with a bit of a baseline for greenhouse gas emissions on the island. And this is what they found. So you can see BC Ferries, it's a ferry-driven transport method there. You have to take the ferry from Victoria or from Vancouver to get there. There's, I think, three ferry terminals on the island that go to different places. So ferry use is a pretty significant contributor to their greenhouse gas emissions. Light vehicles, so this is just sort of regular transport in around the island. Electricity use. This is fairly low because they're hydropowered predominantly. There's some other residential heating sources you can see there. There are a lot of people who still use wood systems. It's a fairly rural community, wood, heating oil, and propane. And then you can see indirect food emissions, I won't get into the details of, but was a bit tricky to quantify. But you can see the percentage of that. It's almost, I think, not quite 40% of the total greenhouse gas emissions accounted for in their study come from food. So quite interesting. They do have a lot of ALR land on the island, but they import a lot of their food. So they included that as part of their baseline study. So you can see total emissions there in tons of CO2 equivalent, and then you can see per capita emissions. BC, they're quite a bit lower than typical per capita emissions for the average British Columbian or Canadian. And I think the reason for that is there isn't really any industry on the island. So there are a lot of hydro compared to other places in Canada. So overall, and maybe it's partly lifestyle, we debated whether or not that was true, but it could be lifestyle choices too. But overall, their average per capita emissions are a bit lower than the rest of BC. So that's sort of context for the study. So what we did was, The local government is called the Islands Trust. They don't actually have their own, Salt Spring Island isn't their own municipality. They're part of this conglomerate called the Islands Trust. And so they've got local representatives from Salt Spring Island that sit on the Islands Trust board. So in the OCP work, they've basically capped the amount of development that they're going to allow on the island at about, so right now I think it's, they've got about about 4,500 dwelling units on the island right now. And the max number of units that are allowed under the current zoning are about 13,000. So it's about, they've got about one third of what they're planning on having on the island. And this is what that looks like. So you can see there's quite a bit of settlement, quite a bit of, distributed settlement on the island. It is very much a rural kind of lifestyle. And so what we wanted to do is map out what that projection was going to look like. So if they do build out to what their current zoning allows them to build out to about that 13,000 units, what does that look like? What are the greenhouse gas emissions associated with that land use pattern? And what are the options that they have in terms of different types of land use patterns that might be more efficient in terms of greenhouse gas emissions? Yep. I don't know how many people, population, I'm not sure.
The number that springs to mind is about 11,000 or 18,000, and speaking to the speaker, because apparently we're being recorded, the population of Salt Spring ranges, I think the numbers are 11,000 to 18,000, and they have a much higher summer population because a lot of people go there for holidays. So that's why the big range.
Okay, so this is basically current situation. And this is what it looks like if they build out, this is sort of our base case scenario, if they build out using the general practices of construction, design, zoning that they've got going on right now. So this is sort of our base case scenario in our research work. So from there we developed a couple of two different alternatives that were unique to one another to be able to compare and contrast different potential future options. And the first one we called the Hamlet scenario, and this is what that one looks like. So what we did here, the two main towns are Ganges, which is, do we have a pointer? This thing? Ganges is here, so that's the main settlement. And Fulford Harbor is the other main settlement. It's a bit smaller, and this is where the ferry to Vancouver Island comes in. One of the ferries from Vancouver Island comes in. So what this scenario did is it put about, I'll go back one second. So I'm going to give you the numbers here. Of the about, so we're at about 4,500 current dwelling units. We're allowed to go up to about 13,000. And of those in our scenario work, we decided to only play around with about 3,500 of them because those were the ones, that number of dwelling units, we could actually shift around because the owners of those properties, if they decided, they would have to go through some kind of subdivision redevelopment exercise in order to be able to further develop their particular properties. So we were only playing with about 3,500 of those units. The other about 5,000 that are the potential future developable land, we actually left like this scenario because those are based on, those other 5,000 units were, it would be really hard for us to take away the development rights of those 5,000 property owners to not develop their properties in future because they were, current zoning allowed them to develop according to this pattern. So we're only playing with, 30-40% of the potential future dwelling units. We were only moving those ones around in our scenarios. So what we did here, there's about 8 hamlets with about 350 units in each, dwelling units in each hamlet. And then we put an additional 350 units in each of Ganges and Fulford. So there's about 10 different, about 8 new sort of clusters. We chose the location of those hamlets based on a potential future public transit route, and also where there were, for the most part, where there were existing concentrations of development already. So it was responding to what's already going on in the island in terms of land use choices. So that scenario, there's a base case, there's a hamlet, and then this is the third scenario, which is villages. So what we did here is we concentrated all that 3,500 units into Ganges and into Fulford. So most of it went into Ganges, with about 1,000 units going into Fulford Harbor. So that's, much more of a dense option. And we used the pattern there. There's a lot of relief on this island. If any of you have ever biked Salt Spring, you'll know this, particularly in and around Ganges. So we paid some attention to existing topography and ability to access water and that kind of thing when we were deciding where to put different dwelling units. So these are both fairly feasible options in terms of future development. We did think through whether or not it would actually be possible to put that many units in Ganges in particular. So what does this look like? So from here, we needed to figure out what we were actually going to analyze, because greenhouse gases come from a lot of places. We had to figure out what we were going to look at in our analysis. So the first, we use these thresholds. So the idea of a threshold is that, for example, the second one there, the number of households within 0.5 kilometers of a town center. We did some literature review to figure out what it would, what kind of assumptions were reasonable to assume that if we had a certain number of dwelling units that met that threshold, they would walk or cycle or find some alternative way of getting to the town center and getting to their services. So these are the thresholds they came up with, or we came up with. And I'm going to go into a couple of them in a little detail just to give you an example of what they look like. So the average trip length, this was a pretty tricky one to do. So what we did here was figured out the number of total trips, the type of trip, meaning the mode of transit that was used, and the percentage of trips by car that were, and we got that information from the regional government. So that was, we had that data available to us. Then we came up with common trip types were converted to assumed destinations. So we picked places like schools, places of work, the grocery store, where are people going to go? Then we used GIS to calculate the distance from households to those destinations. Trip frequency was applied to the total distances, so how many times a week, how many times a month are people going to go to those particular places. Annual vehicle kilometers traveled, and then average emissions per vehicle, given current vehicle stats. So that's kind of how that trip length worked. So I think what's interesting about this is that we didn't use any really complicated GHG modeling software to develop this. We use GIS and, this threshold format to come up with some strategies. We actually initially tried to use a more complicated software tool to do this, but it really did not work for small community analysis. It was just, the software was too complex, and we couldn't get the data that we needed in the right format for us to be able to use that. So another threshold I'll talk about briefly is households within 400 meters of transit. So this is the maximum distance that most people will walk, the average person will walk in order to take the bus. There isn't public transit on public transit is hitchhiking. There isn't really a formal public transit on Salt Spring right now. this assumes that public transit becomes feasible at that population density for all three of the scenarios. So we are comparing it against, comparing apples to apples here. There are obviously going to be different numbers of dwelling units within this 400 meters of the transit, proposed transit route. It assumed ridership rates comparable to the Sunshine Coast, which is a similar community that is attached to a ferry. And so we use the ridership rates, which are fairly low, that came from that kind of, from Sunshine Coast. And then we used GIS to calculate the number of dwelling units in each of those scenarios that were within the 400 meters of the transit loop. We made sure not to overlap the last threshold that I just talked about, the vehicle trips, with public transit ridership.
Forgive me, did you say you're talking about the people that are year-round residents, or
were you counting the seasonal? We accounted as best we could for the seasonal shifts, but that part of it was a little tricky to do because we don't have precise numbers around that, so it was... I don't remember actually how. I think we ended up assuming it was everyone as full-time residents, because it's all really relative comparing a baseline to the others. So, yeah, it's hard to account for that because there's also a lot of seasonal cottages that aren't accounted for in their planning documents. The cottage out in the forest in the back that they rent out as the B&B. So those weren't really accounted for either because we didn't have good info on those. So maybe between the two of those things, somewhere close. Okay. So key assumptions. Only existing and economically viable technologies were considered. So we didn't think about things like potential community energy systems based on fuel cells and that kind of stuff. We used what we currently know that is economically feasible that's out there in the world as assumptions. Set of destinations was created and frequency of trips was assigned. So the local government did have this great, very recent trip behavior study for where people were going and where they lived, but they wouldn't give it to us. So we had to use our best knowledge of the island to come up with this on our own. We did have somebody who lived on Salt Spring Island as part of our team, so we feel pretty confident about those assumptions. The frequency of trips was assumed to remain constant over time. So this may or may not be true. I mean, a lot of things are going to change in the next 20 years that might cause us to drive less, shall we say? But we assume that the frequency of trips is about the same. And all emissions factors are based on existing fuel mixes. So the fuel oil, vehicle fuel use, ferry fuel use, based on existing CO2 equivalents that we know of right now, when that also may change over time. So what did we find? So as you can see here, the baseline's on the left, and the Hamlet was about 7% more efficient. The Hamlet model land use pattern was about 7% more efficient than the baseline. And the village model was about 23% more efficient than the baseline. And the other thing you notice here is the significant percentage of that is how significant transportation is in that assessment. It's about 90% in all three of those scenarios, the greenhouse gas emissions. So this breaks it down a little more. So you can see building energy is not a huge contributor to potential greenhouse gas savings when you look at it, when you study it in this way, when you look at it in the context of land use patterns and options and transport choices. So you can see the other percent savings over the baseline are 7.23%. And per household emissions. We didn't get to per capita emissions, not knowing how many people were going to be living in each house. We didn't take it that far, but we did look at per household emissions. And those are CO2 equivalents. So this is the breakdown of the reduction by threshold. I'm not sure how well you can see the thresholds up there on the top right. But so the largest blue lines there are the average trip length again. Houses within 500 meters of a village, that also relates to amount of vehicle use. So that's the green bar there. Houses within 400 meters of transit is the next one. And then the BC Ferries load reduction. So this one is mostly about fewer cars going on the ferry, more pedestrians, people not taking their vehicles, which allows ferries to operate more efficiently in terms of moving people around. The next one is houses with a density of 35. And that measure is important because at about 35 dwelling units per hectare, community energy systems become feasible. So that's why we were interested in that particular measure. You can see it's the community energy system is not a hugely significant contributor to the reduction. And then we've got houses with a density of 25 is the next one. And that's the one where you start to get building energy efficiency gains because you're building townhouses, more multifamily kinds of developments that have higher energy efficiency in general. Found that once you move from single family units to townhouses with at least one shared wall, you get to almost 30% more energy efficiency just because your density is higher, because your insulation factors go up too.
Lindsay?
Yep.
Just a note for those who are used to Imperial, your house is 35 units per hectare is in the order of 14 units per acre, and 25 is about 10 units per acre. So these are on average sort of a high suburban density to a slightly higher than average suburban density.
Thanks. Thank you, Planner Peter. And the last one is kilometers of road. So we didn't really look at embodied energy here, but we did to a very limited extent in terms of how much energy goes into constructing roads. So the baseline case had a much more significant new road development than the village and hamlet. So that last one is how many kilometers of road were built. So that gives you, again, that tells us a lot about, what the most significant things are in terms of planning our communities, and it really is about, a lot of it is about transportation. And even the making public transit feasible in a small, more rural kind of community like this wasn't a huge contributor. So this one compares a rural house to a village house in terms of their energy performance, taking into account all of those metrics that I just told you. And the village house is about 64% more efficient than the rural house when you take all of those things into consideration. Again, the primary contributor to that is the non-single occupant vehicle transport. Secondary is shorter car trips overall because they're generally closer to where they're trying to go. And then things like energy efficient buildings and community energy systems are sort of a lesser factor, lesser contributor. So we also wanted to just to be rigorous about it. Thanks to Will, we did this. Do a sensitivity analysis to make sure that, you know, what we did is we sort of raised our metrics up 10% to see how our model responded to that change. And overall, the change in greenhouse gases resulting from that rising from increasing our each of these assumptions by about 10% was about 1% difference. So it tells us that the model's fairly robust. These first bars are the transport-related bars. I think they're a little more sensitive to increasing the metrics, those particular metrics, by that 10%. But we figured overall the model is fairly fairly robust and fairly online with giving us accurate results in, you know, again, in relative terms. So things that we didn't look at, as I said earlier, food was a huge contributor to greenhouse gas emissions on the island, but it's kind of a hard thing to measure in this sort of model. What we did around agriculture was we've actually found out that the limiting factor around local food production was not lack of access to land. It was people not using land to produce food. So I think the numbers coming from Salt Spring Island were only about 6% of available agricultural land was actually in production. So because of that, we didn't feel it was other things other than land use choices that were making local food production not really happening on the island. So we didn't include it. And in the placement of the hamlets and in the expansion of the villages, we did take into account where existing agricultural land reserve and potentially functional agricultural land was, and weren't building hamlets and villages on that land. So we were protecting that in those potential future scenarios. We didn't include wastewater. There's also not great data to use on wastewater. And the other thing about Salt Spring is a lot of properties are still on septic, and it's really hard to get information on greenhouse gas emissions from septic systems. So we didn't include that. And we, other than what I told you about the roads, we didn't really include embodied energy. As probably most of you know, it's pretty hard to get good information to include in an analysis like this around embodied energy of different building materials and that kind of thing. So those were not included. So the most important conclusion for us in this study was how important it is when, I mean, we've got these planners working in communities all over the place where we live, and they're working for, you know, to develop these official community plans without having this kind of information. I mean, we know about smart growth, we know about these kinds of principles, we're working with them as best we can. But we're also needing to plan, and we also have this issue of future right to develop land that people have bought that we're up against. And so how do we use information like this in current official community planning processes to keep those future options open and not to close these kinds of doors that prevent us from achieving 23% emissions reductions because of the land use choices that we make? So that was probably the most significant learning from the study. Other things we didn't look at that I think would be really interesting to talk about and are being discussed on the island to a certain extent now are what are the social and economic impacts of the three scenarios? Because we only looked at them through one fairly narrow lens of greenhouse gas emissions, but you know, this is where things get difficult, is when you start talking about social, political, economic implications of our findings. So Will's going to put this up again later, but I'll just leave you with this as a question for discussion for after our presentations, is when significant GHG reductions at the community scale require local governments and citizens to take a leadership role on reallocating development rights, how can we encourage them to do this? Because that's really what it's come down to on Salt Spring, is, you know, political leadership is not ready to say, yes, we're going to change how we're going to develop this island in a really significant way. Thanks.